This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. In this final episode, we will explore the link between Capel Island and the self-proclaimed King of Leinster, Richard de Clare, better known in Irish history as Strongbow. We will also speak to Eddie Fitzgerald, who was one of the last lighthouse keepers on Ballycotton, and we will explore some local folklore from the area. The name Capel Island is an anglicised form of Alone on Coppola, itself taken from the French name de Chapelle. Robert Fitzstevens was one of the leaders of the Norman invasion, for which he was granted extensive lands in Ireland. Philip de Chapelle was one of Robert Fitzstevens' companions during the Norman invasion, and Capel Island was granted to and named after him. The de Chapelles came from Normandy to Kent, and then onwards to Ireland. The de Chapelle name lives on in the East Cork area in the form of Supple and has been made famous by singer, entertainer and musician Art Supple, who has been in the music business since the 1960s as lead singer with one of the leading show bands of the era, the Victors. His son Shane is also an accomplished musician, and he speaks to us about being the present day holder of the de Chapelle name.
The name Supple as it is today is not a kind of a very common name. So I get a lot of people from America, Australia, New Zealand, different places around the world contacting me, wanting to know, is this where we came from originally? 1153, I think, is when de la Capelles arrived in Ireland for the first time. And over a period of time, the barony of Imekilly was under their rule, which had been given to them for helping out. At some point, the name changed from de la Capelle to Supple. And I honestly don't know where the name came from, but Capel Island, as it's known now, I think a lot of it might have had to do with the changeover, we'd say, in before Ireland became a republic and things like that, where the English names, or the English had different names for the Irish towns. And I think that might have been part of it as well. They might have thought De La Capelle was an Irish name, so they were pronouncing it as just change it to Supple, you know. So that's the French translation that we keep getting anyway. And Capel Island would have been something similar, if you know what I mean. It was changed to that. But I never came across any link to de la Capelle as to when they actually lived, moved, or what they done with the island, as to moving off the island and handing it back to a government, or the British government, or the Irish government later.
So it's a mystery.
It is, and some local historians have done research, and they've never been able to come up with a link either, as to, you know, the name is the only link we have, and we can't prove that we were there, because I don't think there was ever a title deed, if you know what I mean. That's going back to the island. It's just, it was accepted at the time that it was belonged to the Capelle family, and once they took over the barony of Imekilly, I suppose anything within that region was under their control on behalf of the king at the time. So here seems to be a starting point for a lot of the Supples, but going from here back, it's not happening, because it's just the 11th century.
Ballycotton Lighthouse is one of the most famous lighthouses in the area and was inhabited until 1992, when the lighthouse was converted to automatic operation. The three lighthouse keepers were withdrawn from the station, and one of the last lighthouse keepers, Eddie Fitzgerald, shares his insights into life on a remote island.
There was a couple of things. You have to be honest and say, look, that was the better place to put the lighthouse, you know. If the lighthouse was on Capel, so there would be someone, then there would be, obviously, they'd be looking for stores, and there'd be a local boatman, there'd be a taxi man for taking them to shopping, and all that kind of thing went with lighthouse service. More than likely, there'd be a small, maybe a bigger village down in at the head, and there'd probably be a shop, probably be a pub, there could be a hotel there by now. I reckon that probably would have happened. I reckon, you know, but that's the way it is. So you can see the old head, you can see it from Ballycotton. You can see mine head from Ballycotton. But unfortunately from Capel, you can't see the old head, you can see it. And they tended to do that because, again, it was the era of sailing boats. And for coastal traffic on a sailing ship at that time, you had the compass, and you had, some of them had a log which they throw, or a knot line. And they were taking bearings then off of headlands and lighthouses and maybe churches or whatever they could take a bearing off to get ID where they were. When a ship would leave one lighthouse, they'd like to see the next one if they could, you know, in fine weather anyway. Thick weather they wouldn't see it, but in fine weather. So if passing Capel, you wouldn't see the hotel, you can see it. Left on, you're way out. It's too far away then, but from Ballycotton you can. We say no boat entering Cork Harbour at that time. If they struck land maybe off of Ballycotton or maybe Knockadoon, they'd be doing quite well. You know, and they'd say, oh yeah, we're here now, we've got to make our way back towards Carcar. But that would have been quite good, you know. A lot of boats, like, at that time, if they were 20 or maybe 20 miles away from their designated port, they'd be quite happy with that, they'd be good. When they started building Ballycotton then, both Ballycotton and Minehead came on operation the same night, 1st of June in 1851. So the boats and Mudder came in together. But really, you didn't need a light on cable to navigate into Yall. You didn't really. Once you had a light in my head, you were going to clear that hazard. And once you opened up Yall Bay, then you'd pick up the internal light inside. But getting back to what I was saying, between Ballycotton and Roach's Point, on the headland of Powerhead, there was a what they call a fog signal station, which was discontinued because in the early 70s, I remember working there, so you'd no light there, which was a fog signal, in fog, there'd be a signal sounded there. What happened then, as technology was coming, that was discontinued. So cable might have been discontinued at some stage. They said, look, we don't need it.
Back in the 1920s, the area of Ring and Ballymacoda were recognised as a Fór Gaeltacht, a primarily Irish-speaking region. Daniel Corkery, a prominent Irish politician and academic, described locals in Knockadoon as speaking Irish with a richness and fluency that has excelled in only one or two other hidden places in Munster. Older members of the community remember when Irish was their first language, with stories, songs and everyday conversations held as Gaeilge. Although sadly the strength of the language throughout the region of Knockadoon and Ballymacoda has greatly declined, it lives on to the hundreds of young people who visit Knockadoon camp every summer to practice their cúpla focal. A very famous Irish poet, Piarais MacGarrat, was born in the area, and his poem Róis Cátha na Muin holds a special place in Irish history.
Datnias féin gan bréige rocht is ar anfa hétis taobh le cún ar chana na néan go séasach súr go gosach ma héasúr glé gan grún. Masam gur suach don bhuan an uam is do marion go dúach do cruan na mua. Tarran na don le shlasaf na long ag tarant go déan nor géan ar cuart.
There are numerous English translations of the poem, but this one is by Dr. Robert Dwyer Joyce, who studied medicine in UCC before emigrating to Boston in 1866. He was a regular contributor of poems and stories to The Nation and Irish People newspaper.
Battle Cry of Munster, English translation by Joyce. I knew it well by storm and cold, the waves which lash the shore foretold. The birds' sweet notes in forest tell, our prince comes over ocean's swell. 'Tis time for Munster now to cheer, 'twill glad our wasting clans to hear. The dash of the wave, gainst the ships of the brave, and gallant hearts that are drawing near.
Folklore handed down through the generations includes the story of Capel Island's ghost lurking in the Black Man's Cave, believed to be that of a Muslim man drowned on a shipwreck and buried by locals on the island. It is said he was laid to rest facing east, as locals at that time felt it would not be right to bury him in the local Catholic cemetery. Other stories include sirens calling sailors to their doom off the rocks and the practice of giving rocks surrounding Capel Island their own name.
It's true to say that most places were named after noteworthy features of the landscapes, such as hills, rocks, valleys, lakes and harbours. The name Knockadoon derives from Cnoc an Dún, which means the hill of the fortress, suggesting the site could once have been the seat of a chieftain in times gone by. Capel Island has many such landmarks, all given Irish names by locals, such as Carrigatuha, located opposite the landing slip, which translates as Rock of the People or the Tribe's Rock. On the northeast of the island stands Cúnia na Méire, meaning cornerstone. We have a very exotic sounding Carrig na Seangacha, or Rock of Shanghai, and Carrig na Bhuildach, whose origin is unknown. Underwater rocks are also given names: Carriga Rubin, Robin Rock, Carriga Calla, Harbour Rock, and Carrig Connor, Connor's Rock. On the eastern end of the island, a huge finger of rock points towards the sky. It has been compared to the Wailing Woman on Skellig Michael. Local legend says it is an obelisk wagging its finger in warning at seafarers to be ever vigilant of some foreboding event. Currently, it is a rest stop for migrating birds and a home to a colony of breeding cormorants.
The final part of our documentary will share some stories from the area that may not have been heard before.
Capel Island has an area of 9 acres. 9 acres of land that was precious to our ancestors who lived and died by the land. The local people in the 1800s lived off whatever the land and sea could provide, and so small cottage industries were often created to put food on the tables of large families, and if possible, maybe make a modest living from it. Enterprising locals turned one local commodity into a profit by gathering and cultivating a product known as dulesk, or carrageen moss. Carrageen moss literally translates as little rock. Locals gathered this red algae, which grew in abundance on the rock outcrops on the northeast of the island, and sold them to supplement their modest incomes in the name of Capel. The Bannantee of the time also recognised carrageen's medicinal qualities, and so it would be taken for ailments as diverse as coughs, cancer and peptic ulcers. In East Cork, locals also believed that carrageen moss was good for sick calves, who were necessary to keep small farm holdings in the black. In the old days, it was said that women's priorities in the Irish household in small fishing communities such as ours were often ranked as prati, pashti, fiowin, potatoes, children and seaweed. Meals were often supplemented by seaweed with carrageen moss, pudding a regular meal. The pudding may not be fashionable in domestic cooking anymore, but our best chefs all revere it. It seems the Bannantee was onto something way back when.
Another story passed down from generation to generation is that of enterprising Knockadoon locals and their connection with Pope Pius XII.
Surprisingly, Knockadoon has a rich history in the hand-weaving industry. At one point, the local enterprise employed up to 30 spinners from the surrounding area up until the 1940s. So important were the skills of spinning and weaving in early Ireland that the Brehon Laws laid down, as part of a wife's entitlement in case of divorce, that she should keep her spindles, wool bags, weaver's reeds and share of the yarn she had spun and the cloth she had woven. The husband, however, was optional. Knockadoon weavers found worldwide fame, however, when the spinners created a woven jumper made of white wool, known locally as a bonneen, and sent it to the then Pope, Pope Pius XII. Apparently, El Papa was impressed by the gesture and sent the people of Knockadoon a letter from the Vatican thanking them for their skilled and considerate gesture. Sadly, no pictures of the pontiff actually wearing the Foster and Allen-esque jumper exists, so we can only assume the Italian climate didn't suit it.
We finish our story where it all began. What follows is the actual original report of the sinking of the Sirius steamer in London's daily newspaper, printed on Wednesday, January the 20th, 1847.
Between 3 and 4 o'clock on Saturday morning, the vessel, having made an excellent passage from Dublin to the offing of Cork Harbour, struck a reef of rocks in Ballycotton in a dense fog. Passengers were immediately plunged into a scene of consternation, with Captain Moffat, the commander, deeming it advisable to back the ship off the reef and by much exertion with the engines, succeeded in doing so. They were only a very short time clear of the rocks when it became evident that the vessel would not remain afloat, as she was making water fast. She was again turned towards the land and very soon after began to strike a ledge called Smith's Rocks, about half a mile to the west of Ballycotton, with the certainty of going into pieces in a few hours. The total loss of the vessel being thus inevitable, the attention of all on board was directed to the preservation of the crew and passengers. Amidst the confusion, the lifeboat was attached to the davits and lowered, though unfortunately on the wrong side of the ship. This boat, we understand, was not equal to accommodate more than 8, but 20 crowded into her, and before she was well clear of the steamer, she was swamped, and all in her met a watery grave. Meanwhile, the steamer continued to thump heavily on the rocks, while the screams of alarms from the affrighted passengers and the heavy surf breaking on her side and on the deck rendered a scene of awful danger and intense anxiety. Soon after, the Coast Guard boat from Ballycotton Station, under the command of Mr. Coughlin, chief officer, came alongside, and the remaining passengers were safely landed, though with the loss of every portion of their luggage. The commander of the vessel, Captain Moffat, who had a reputation of being a skillful and experienced seaman, is described as being almost out of his mind at the occurrence. It is, however, next to a certainty that the want of a lighthouse on Capel Island, which the shipping interests of this city have been so long contending for, is one of the main causes of this dreadful catastrophe. The number of passengers and crew on board the Sirius was as near as can be ascertained about 90, 71 of whom have been saved. None of the bodies are as yet found, but it was thought that in the course of Sunday the 2nd of January, they would be washed ashore.
Ilan an Coppola, The Lighthouse That Never Was, was made by Capel Island Productions. This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. Written, produced and presented by Orla Reardon, edited by Sean Healy.